As the recruiting world turns, so do your ears turn back to the Pick Six podcast here, late January edition 2022. I'm Evan Bland with Sam McEwen and Jimmy Watkins of the Omaha World Herald, catching up here at another sort of cross section of sports happenings. We're coming off of NFL divisional weekend. Nebraska men and women's hoops are still on COVID pause, getting ready to come off of that. Baseball's a month away from starting, and football is the recruiting news cycle that never stops. But man, before we get to some of this other stuff, I want to hear about Sam's Twitter account and the journey that he went from having it stolen away from him to now being back where he can talk with us on social media. How did that go?
I promised I would tell the story. I will try to keep it short. This will be a cautionary tale about not always believing everything that you see on Twitter. Hello and welcome, everyone. Here's what I'll say. Last Tuesday, right around this time, in fact, I was sent a direct message by something called the Twitter Help Desk. And on top of that, it was verified. It was a verified account for Twitter Help Desk that indicated that I had committed copyright infringement on someone else, some other reporter who does not live in this area, their account by retweeting something that was apparently proprietary. Now, for what it's worth, it wasn't proprietary, and I didn't retweet anything that was wrong, and that should have been my first tell, but I wasn't paying very good attention. So like a good Twitter person that I am, I tried to figure out what that problem was, and I was told that I had to reset this and reset that, and in doing that, just send them a code, just send Twitter and this DM a code. Obviously, if my DMs hadn't been opened, I don't think I would have gotten this, but they were, because I'm a reporter and I get open DMs all the time for people sending me tips. So anyway, I put this little code in, and the second that I did that, it was inputted into my account and I lost control of my account. I lost control of my account to someone in Turkey, Istanbul, Turkey, or thereabouts, near about there. And in losing my account to this person, I was locked out. There's nothing I could do. And the first thing that this particular person thought would be a good idea to do would be to tweet something about Turkish soccer that I knew nothing about, or soccer in the Netherlands or Turkey. I'm not quite sure. But they sent this out, and I had no idea what it meant, because it was not translated. Then when I translated, I still didn't have much of an idea of what it meant. And it created an absolute uproar. An absolute uproar. What then happened is I started my own account to try to communicate with the person who took my account and ask for it back. And they attempted to extort me. They wanted money. They wanted crypto coin. They wanted $500, I guess, crypto to get the account back. And I wasn't going to do that. And in the process of them sending out that tweet, obviously lots of people in the local market reacted and thought that was kind of funny. And it was kind of funny in a way until I started getting contacted by people via Instagram, people who found my phone, email, who were interested in why I tweeted that, including one of the people in the tweet reached out to my World Herald address and asked for a retraction. And I said, well, I've been hacked, so I cannot retract it because I don't have that account, obviously. And then people who saw my new Twitter account saw that I said it posted misinformation and all this other stuff. Then I was contacted by journalists asking for clarification. One, I think, was to Instagram, and then one texted me straight away and said, why did you tweet this? And, you know, and asked what the issue was, and did I tweet that? Why did I tweet it? And I was like, who is this? And this was late in the evening. This was like 11 o'clock. Who is this? How did you get my number? And then they sent me a copy of my email signature, which obviously came from this person who emailed me about, you know, about whatever. And I responded back to them. And so I'm like, well, I was hacked. And so like, we went back and forth and it was kind of weird. It was late in the middle of the night. And then, I don't know, many, many emails with Twitter support trying to clear this up. The person had apparently done many things. One, they had blocked several people in the local media market. Two, they had changed the age start date of the account to a child. And so I believe the account was deactivated. And so Twitter had to go back in and change the date. And then they had to change the email. And then I had to change an email on another account. And then Twitter had to come back and change the age on the account. And then when the account came back, I had to unblock everybody. But nevertheless, I got it back in about 48 hours. And what I can tell you is that it is just a weird experience to be affiliated. You do not realize very easily sometimes how bound up part of your identity is in that account and the followers that you have on it and the duty that you feel to share your coworkers' work. And I think you would both agree that I share your guys' work. The duty you feel to your coworkers to share their work and the fact that if you feel like you have to start from scratch, that feels like in that moment a particularly daunting feeling, right? And so I don't want to compare it to the movie Her. I don't know if anybody's ever seen that movie. Have either one of you seen it?
No.
Okay. So it's a really interesting and thoughtful movie. It's about AI, essentially, artificial intelligence, that
I have seen this.
So it becomes close to an individual person. And so each person is sort of, you know, has an individual AI character. And at the end of the movie, for people who have not seen it, I'm sorry, I'm spoiling it. The AI decides collectively that it no longer wants to be affiliated with people because it's taking people too long to respond. The AI has, you know, has evolved. And so the AI just all leaves. And so everybody loses their person right at the AI at the same time. And so there's a scene where everybody's just sort of wandering around knowing what they're doing. I experienced about a fraction of that in the sense of like, I had this account, it's now gone. I may not get it back. I have to reset from zero. Everything begins again. And it felt like for a second, it just felt like, you know, all that work I'd put into it. And of course, it really means very little, but it was gone, you know? And so I was talking to my wife about when I created the account and when I went over 1,000 the first time, which was, by the way, the day Nebraska went to the Big Ten. And all of those sort of nascent dates within the context of the account. And I was surprised at how much thought I had about that, you know, and then I accumulated all the time that I had spent on that account and how. And this is real, you know, in terms of the digital reality we live in, how it was just gone. Now I got it back, but I wasn't sure I was going to get it back. And it just gives you a sense of how fleeting digital records can be. Like if the internet went out, as it does in people who have read the book or seen the miniseries Station 11, you would lose everything. Like it would be gone. We do all of our banking online. We do all these things online. And so to have this small, tiny compromise of one's digital identity, it does open a window to how much we over rely on, you know, the way that we live our world today.
And I told you, Sam, I wish I had that original tweet that whoever it was tweeted it out, because it was so ridiculous and over the top. But like I told you, there was a small part of me that was like, maybe you did tweet that because you're a man of many interests and somebody who kind of gets involved in a lot of different things. And I think a lot of other of your actual followers thought the same thing initially, until things went sideways. But yeah, it was weird on the outside. We called it Zombie Sam, and Zombie Sam relocated to the Netherlands or whatever. And so from the outside, I empathize with your situation, but at the same time, dang it, it was kind of funny, just some of the stupid things they did. And it's funny now because you got it back. But man, that's a story.
Right.
I would just say it's interesting that you say how fleeting digital records can be, Sam, because we're also, at least me, like growing up with this stuff, we're taught that it all can be so permanent, right? Like, you know, something you send, and we've seen this, something that an athlete sends out on Twitter when they're 14 can be potentially harmful to them when they're 24 and getting drafted or whatever. That's just a weird dichotomy to me. And also, you're right that we spend too much time and put too many resources and depend too heavily on the internet. I don't, like, what's the alternative there? Like, you're keeping your money in a mattress? I don't know what we're supposed to do. We don't have too many choices.
Yeah, I don't want to keep my money in my mattress. Like, yeah, like, but I mean, you know, 30 years ago, people banked without the internet. It wasn't mattress internet.
Right.
I'm not saying you lose the ATM. I'm just saying that digital footprint just seems enormously important.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's good stuff. So everything's back safe and sound.
Yeah.
I mean, I experienced a small version of that last fall where I was hacked briefly, where I was notified on my phone that somebody had logged into my account because I guess the password wasn't all that strong. And I knew I had like 30 seconds to change the password before this person locked me out. And I couldn't get into a spot where I could do that in time. And so I was locked out. I was not extorted or anything so dramatic, but it is. It's this weird sort of, I guess I kind of felt like it was this weird sort of violation where somebody else was in my house or somebody else was in
the
thing that belonged to me. And I needed to make it clear to people that, like, I wasn't in control of it right now. This wasn't me. And like you said, it's so fleeting in the big picture, but in that moment it does, it feels a little dirty and it feels wrong. So how about you, Jimmy? Have you ever been hacked?
I was going to provide, in the interest of both sidesism, I have some experience as the hacker. When I was in, I think, seventh grade, I don't know, 12 or 13, I knew me and my best friend, who's still one of my closest friends to this day. We knew each other's passwords for like everything and all that. So I would hack into his Facebook and just comment on pictures of girls we knew, like, wowza. Or, you know, wow, gosh, you're pretty, like just dumb stuff like that. And it took him a while to figure out that it was me, but he got very upset with me when he realized it was me, but I had a great time doing it.
I used to be a prank caller. We don't need to go over that, but I did do that.
No. The age of pre-caller ID when you could do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I don't think anybody really minded my pranks for the most part. I called on behalf of Chicken Fried Steak International. I was a chicken fried steak wholesaler. Southern foods.
Did you have an accent?
I tried one, yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't very good.
Hmm.
It was not good at all. You know, chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes, cream gravy, potatoes, stuffing. You know, sort of a Thanksgiving dinner, only with a Southern twist.
Okay.
Thought it was funny that, yeah, it was this harmless.
So what's the prank? What's the prank there?
I'm not sure what it was exactly. Getting people to believe that I was actually selling that? I don't know.
Just the deception.
That's a really good question.
Well, these are the...
I had to think about that issue myself. But, you know, I've found that many, many times in my life, and my wife would affirm this, that I do things without much of a deeper purpose there. I do some absurd things just to be absurd. I'm sorry.
Some people just like to watch the world burn.
Yeah, that's right. Or eat chicken fried steak for that.
Well, again, these are the mid-January conversations that we have when basketball's on COVID pause and football season's not happening, though there's still plenty going on there. I don't know, anything basketball related you want to touch on, Jimmy, with just the last week? I know they haven't played, but any main?
Well, we did talk to Kobe Webster and Fred Hoiberg about the Kobe Webster radio comments from last week. If you're somehow still not aware of those, basically, Kobe went on the radio last Tuesday with 93.7 The Ticket and was talking about how basically Nebraska had some accountability issues within their locker room and was saying that if the coaches don't hold the players accountable, how can the players hold their teammates accountable in the context of, you know, Hoiberg talking about player-led teams and all that. So Fred, in a sort of a method acting sort of way, held Kobe accountable. He put him in front of the media and he said, all right, you said this, now you got to deal with it. And Kobe sort of brushed back everything that was asked. He didn't really shed any further light. I think he understood that, I mean, in seeing his answers or lack thereof, his non-answers, basically saying, I'm trying to learn from this, blah, 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 all this stereotypical stuff that you say when you say something you shouldn't have said. He communicated that he understood that he did something that he shouldn't have done. On the other hand, the actual words he said, he kept saying, I didn't think it would end up like this. I didn't think I'd be, you know, having to answer for whatever I said on the radio in a press conference. And I don't want to, part of the story should be about, okay, well, if Kobe's saying this, there's probably something to it. But what we're focused on right now is, why did you say it in a public forum? And when you said it in a public forum, how could you not think that that was going to turn into something? Like the weight of what he said, like when you're suggesting that the coach, not only are players not listening to the coach, but the coach, there's no reprimand for that. That I don't see how you can connect the dots there and think that there's not going to be anything that comes of that. And beyond that, there's like an unwritten, doesn't even need to be written or spoken, rule in sports that like the locker room is kind of our sanctuary. This is our, the team is our family. The locker room is our family meeting room. If we have an issue, we're going to address it in there or in a coach's office or whatever else. And it's going to stay inside the locker room. Right. And that rule has now been broken. And that creates a weird vibe within the team. Like I haven't been able to talk to any other players about this because of the COVID pause, but like, I can't imagine that everyone is feeling super, like, I can't imagine that everyone in that locker room is looking at Kobe Webster as the most trustworthy figure in that locker room right now. I think he's like, I don't know if he had to talk, if he's talked to the team as a whole or anything since, because again, the COVID pause is weird. But I feel like there is some repair that needs to be done there, because like a serious rule of athlete and team culture has been broken here. And I hope that is understood and addressed, because if it's not, then it opens the door for some other really ugly stuff. And yes, again, what he said deserves to be heard and given its merit. And we should, when we see, you know, if we see a player, if one player takes a bad shot and they're taken out of the game, and then another player takes a bad shot and they're not taken out of the game, we should note that. We should ask about that. But we should also, as from the player's side, you got to keep that stuff in house. Like that's one of the oldest athlete locker room culture isms that exists. So that's what I would say about that.
It's interesting because, you know, I think this is the sort of thing that could come up more often these days in the NIL era. I mean, the fact that he was on a station having a show in the first place was, I think, part of the NIL reality that we live in. And so there's going to be more opportunity for athletes to give voice to things like that. And they're going to feel more comfortable in some of these situations doing that than they would have before. So I think that's interesting. And kind of like I touched on last week too, like part of me feels like while that's certainly not a rule that you want to break necessarily or whatever, like the dynamic is different with a team that's 0-8 in the Big Ten versus like a top 25 team from, you know, maybe a disgruntled player who's not getting playing time or something like that. So like, you know, the real downside is what? They continue to lose games. They continue to like guys leave, I suppose. So I don't know. I'm still sort of curious, one, how this carries over, because it's been, what, a week since he said it and they haven't played any games because of the COVID pause. So one, how much does it carry over? And two, if it does, you know, again, maybe you shake things up and the results are a little different than they have been. So it's sort of an interesting dynamic, I think, when you look at Nebraska's situation specifically too.
To your point, to your point about the NIL, I said this to Sam last week. It's not so. Yes, the NIL is an element of it. You're getting money from this interview. Inherently, when people give you money, you're gonna feel a little bit more friendly towards them. That's just, if someone walked up on the street, gave me $20, I'd be like, "Hey, man, nice hat," or something like that. But also, we have a former athlete in the room, Rashawn Jackson. Like, there's some sort of like, I don't know if Kobe like knows what Rashawn Jackson did as a football player at Nebraska, but there is like a fraternity to being an athlete where when you're talking to a former athlete, like I watch guys who do interviews on TNT and NBA TV, some of those former athletes, they don't ask good questions really ever. They don't ask, you know, they didn't go to journalism school. Clearly they're not always asking open-ended questions. They often ramble too long, but they still kind of get good answers sometimes just because the guys who they're asking the questions to respect them, like know their resume and know who they were, like that sort of stuff matters. So I do think that, I don't know. I love Evan's take that this could be like a four-dimensional chess move from Kobe Webster, like just trying to shake up the juju a little bit. But I think part of it was also like Kobe has done several of these interviews. These people are, you know, he's getting money from them. He's feeling good about that. And there's another athlete in the room. So he just feels really comfortable. And I think he may have forgotten the setting he was in, which may have caused him to say a little bit more than he might say otherwise.
I think that's all good stuff. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a tough spot. Jamie, I thought you had a good story on Sunday. A lot of people read it. A lot of people agreed with me that it was a good story. Yeah, I do feel like there's a sense of defiance in Fred Hoiberg at this moment. Fred, you had the headline, Fred Fights Back. I mean, his version of fighting is a little bit different than maybe mine or someone else's, but does feel like he feels very committed to trying to get this right. And as I kind of read, you know, Webster's response on Friday, I think Webster won't be having any more interviews where he questions his coach. What do you think?
I would think that's a fair assumption. Even if like not because Fred took him in a back room and gave him a tongue lashing. I just think that was all much more than Kobe Webster wanted to deal with. And when you go through something like that, I think naturally he'll just clam up. I think in all interview settings, I think he'll be a lot more careful going forward, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that's fair. I mean, he had the criticism that he lobbied was effectively, I can't hold anybody accountable because my coaches won't hold them accountable. That's a okay. Like, and the other thing, and I think I mentioned this to you, Jimmy, is I wonder if this is a 5 week old problem or a 5 day old problem. I think if it were, you know, at the beginning of the season, things just weren't very right. And man, we didn't hold people accountable at the beginning of the year and in training camp. And this all stems from that. I get that. I don't think the team that took the floor and lost to Indiana was an unaccountable group of players. I just don't. Like, I feel like what he was recounting there was something similar to the criticism that he gave to you after the first Indiana game, where like, we can't do things because because the ball's sticking. And at that particular time, I thought that was a legitimate concern. I don't know that yes, Verge is still making some mistakes and McGowan's does too, but you can't bench those guys for like whole stretches of the game and not expect to get, you know, beat by 40.
Yeah, I think that to your point about the Indiana stuff earlier, like, yeah, the breaking off of the plays or whatever, you know, not hearing the plays. I think that stuff is mostly in the past. Although after the Illinois game, I think there was a similar concern that Bryce raised where they weren't, I think he said it, they weren't communicating the plays the right way at the end of that game. And Hoiberg confirmed that there was one instance where he called the play and it didn't, for whatever reason, you know, they used the word communication. I'll tell you that the play ended in an Alonzo Verge, you know, double pump contested mid-ranger. So take from that what you will, but they have brought that similar concerns like that since then. But to the point about Fred, I think this is just a dude. There's a dude who's like, he's tired of hearing, I don't know how much of the noise gets back to him, but here's two things that I know. I know that Fred is very confident because of his experience at Iowa State, very confident in his ability to turn this thing around the way he's doing it, right? Like the way they sort of rated the transfer market, the style that they played, even though they've changed it up a little bit recently, they're still very confident that can be the tools that they use to turn it around here. I also know that there are a bunch of fans, former players, media members who disagree with that sentiment. And I think that the Kobe thing was probably an avenue to magnify all that noise where I'm not saying that Fred's scrolling through his Twitter mentions or anything like that, but when something like that happens, it just opens your eyes to more of that conversation because you're not looking for it, but then you see it. It just comes up more often naturally. So I think he's just tired of hearing that stuff. He's like, look, guys, I've won a Big 12 tournament title before. You guys aren't. You guys haven't done any of that. And I just think that he, in his own way, like you said, Sam, he kind of just, it was one answer to one question that I asked him, but he very sternly defended his reputation real quick for about, I don't know, 60, 70 seconds. And that is, like you said, for Fred, who normally keeps it very close to the chest, very relaxed, very not going to show up. He doesn't show a ton of emotion. That's about as close to fighting back as you're going to get from that guy. So I just think it was a little bit of a check to his audience. Like, guys, I actually do know what I'm doing here. It's not the players are not running wild. Like there's a plan here, and you just simmer down for a second.
Does
he can't clone himself to play the games, unfortunately.
does what Nebraska does on the court in the next few weeks change that narrative at all? I mean, does, you know, they're 0-8, what are they playing for at this point? Is it to change or to defend sort of what Fred's talking about here, or I guess what's at stake here down the stretch?
Well, I mean, more and more, again, the more games they lose, like, it's a hefty buyout, but Fred's job is in some way on the line here. I don't think that they will fire him. I think that given some of the stuff that he's been through his first 2 years, and also we can play the who else you're going to get game, I don't know that it would be necessarily super wise to hire him. I don't know that he's had enough runway to get everything done that to show that he can or can't do it. But if you don't win Big Ten games, it's hard to argue that then if they turn in a season in the third year that's as bad or worse than their first one, where they had more legit excuses, like something's going to change there. So that's the stakes going forward. But like, yeah, Fred's reputation within Nebraska is certainly on the line. I mean, Fred, I feel like Fred's reputation among the Nebraska fan base is on the line every game they play. Like one blowout after the comments in my Twitter mentions after the blowout, it's just depressing, man. Like when getting blown out by Rutgers, I get it. Rutgers is a good home team, but like, that's just something that shouldn't happen. The talent is even at worst. Like that's something that shouldn't happen. And then like, to a certain extent, I think Fred will always have a job in the NBA if he wants it, but his reputation in the coaching world, you know, like you lose a bunch of games, like to this level, if you're going to take a hit to people who don't know you. If you, again, he has immense respect in the coaching world for what he did at Iowa State, but I do think it, his reputation has taken a hit since he's gotten to Nebraska. I think it's hard to argue that stuff. So yeah, that, I guess that's what they're playing for going forward. The bigger thing is, yeah, like keeping the same infrastructure. That's what they're playing for, of course, but more on a more micro level, it's convincing the fans that there's reason for hope.
Speaking of reason for hope, Nebraska football recruiting continues to move on. And just a little bit of a reset with that. So Nebraska, its 2022 class is all but wrapped up at this point. One of their official visitors from earlier this month, Kylan Griffin out of Alabama, commits to Clemson today. So he's off the board, and really the only other 2022 prep guy that Nebraska is sort of in on is running back AJ Allen, who's a TCU commit currently. He visited last week as well, although it sounds, the more and more you hear from people close to him, it sounds like it might be between TCU and Mississippi State. So that class is pretty well close to wrapped up at this point. They have a school record 17 mid-year additions on campus now, 9 of those in the transfer portal. And so that's obviously going to be a conversation that we'll have moving forward. What does that look like in the spring? But sort of for the purposes of this podcast, I thought we could look at just sort of some of the other recruiting trends as we shift focus to 2023. Nebraska had a Juniors Day last weekend where they had about 20 or so higher end regional prospects in. They're going to have another one this coming Saturday. Same, I wanted to ask you kind of about what you wrote about on Sunday as it relates to Mickey Joseph and in-state recruiting. And it kind of feels like the doom and gloom that has surrounded Nebraska recruiting Omaha sort of has flipped in the last couple of weeks with the inroads that Mickey Joseph has made getting around. He lived in Omaha for a time. I guess what's your sense as to the impact that Joseph can have in flipping Nebraska's fortunes recruiting the Metro?
Well, I think there's a couple of things here that are salient. One of them is that Joseph has a kind of energy and motivation that is internal and is not. Certainly, when you have good recruiters, you want to have some organization to it, some structure to it. You don't want it to just turn into pick a player, right? To be honest with you, I think Nebraska's basketball team is running into a little bit of that, where it's four-star this, five-star that, four-star this, four-star this. Does any of it fit? You know, that kind of thing. But really good recruiters are really good recruiters. And when you're a really good recruiter, I think you have an internal motivation and organization and passion for it that's not unlike sales. And you're not waiting for somebody's permission to go tell somebody that you love them. You know, you're not waiting for somebody's permission to go land a good recruit. And so I think when Joseph recruits, it's not necessarily on a how do you want me to handle this? What do you want me to do here? Now he just goes and does. And I think Bill Bush is very similar in this regard. And part of what you do is you get the guys, you get in the living room, and then you kind of sort it out later. It's like sometimes in journalism, you ask the questions, or you do what you got, you report the story and you ask for permission of whether you should have asked that question after the fact. Really good reporters just go get stories. They don't keep going back and saying, you know, how do you want me to execute this? Or, and so I think some of what Mickey Joseph is about is that you could take that anywhere. It could be at Kansas State. It could be at Nebraska. It could be at Iowa. It could be anywhere. So I think that's part of the component here. The second part of the component is that he has relationships in Omaha. They go back a ways, but you know, he's a familiar name, and there's people whom he played with who still live in Omaha. And I think there's a sense of he's not coming into it the way that, say, Hank Hughes did. I'm trying to knock Hank Hughes. Reggie Davis did some Omaha recruiting. Reggie didn't know anybody. Like it wasn't that Reggie was a bad recruiter. It's just Mickey can walk into some places and already kind of know a few things. That's an advantage to him. He's not Matt Lubick. And Matt was a different cat, just different in his comportment and lots of things. And then, you know, in talking to Michael Huffman at Bellevue West, I think he's like, hey, Barrett Root was doing a great job, but Barrett Root is a linebacker's coach. And a lot of the kids that come out of Omaha don't play linebacker. The one who did, Nick Henrich, is at Nebraska. But a lot of the guys that, you know, Nebraska's trying to get out of there are running backs and wide receivers and corners. That coach, Root, does not coach that position. And Mickey recruits skill. He recruits skill guys. Right, mostly wide out, but also perhaps running back, corner, whatever. And he's able to, you know, and so I think you're going to see him do a good job of kind of putting an anchor there and prioritizing Nebraska kids, making these kids feel wanted, making them feel loved, making them feel like they're important. And I don't know that that's always been a consistent message up there. You know, and so some of that, I mean, I think those are probably the two biggest qualities. Is some of it is he's just a really, really good recruiter. And you know what a good recruiter is. Like, you just know. And Nebraska probably has the two best recruiters that they've had under Scott Frost right now, in Bush and Joseph. And you're going to miss at times. You're going to bring guys in that don't fit, but the whole point is you get a lot of guys who really, really want to recruit, and you bring them all in, and they bring good football players to the program, and then you start, and then you've got to have the whatever to develop them. And if there's one thing I'll say about Wandale Robinson, Wandale, I think, was the highest-rated recruit Nebraska's brought in, right? Under Frost?
Yeah. And he left.
They did an okay job with Wandale, but not good enough. Once he got here, you know, you have to understand, and this is hard for people to wrap their heads around sometimes, including in Nebraska. Elite athletes got to be elite, not because it dropped out of the sky and fell in their lap, but because they put the time and the effort in to become elite. All right. Like, we have a mindset just generally that a five-star kid is entitled. Like, there's just that, well, that guy over there must, you know, he's a five-star, so he's entitled. BS. He didn't get to be a five-star by acting entitled. He got to be a five-star because he's really, really good. Like 99% of the time, unless it's a quarterback, and sometimes you can miss on quarterbacks because you can fall in love with their arm slot or whatever, you know, like they did with Shane Morris or Garrett Gilbert once upon a time. Most of the time, these kids are five-stars because they're really good players, and they're really good because they work at it. And a really good recruiter understands that high-level, top 100 players, actually what they want is to be really good. And that's what they have based their entire career on. And so you've got to give them the tools to go from good to great. And I think sometimes when it came to Wandale Robinson, I don't know that the tools were always there. What I think Nebraska, what this staff got used to is, oh, we're going to take this three-star from over here in, you know, Orlando or Tampa, whom people didn't recruit because maybe he had so-so grades, but oh man, this kid can run, you know, a 10-900, and he's happy with playing at UCF, and we'll develop him, and he'll do all the things we tell him to do. High-level athletes ask why a lot. A lot of them have personal trainers. A lot of them are really good players, but they look at a coaching staff as a development tool, not as this is the only person who would ever give me a chance. And so some of what any given group has to figure out over time is how do you balance between these elite players over here who you want in your program, but when you bring them in, their expectation level for you is higher in some cases than the kids that you brought in that are just happy to be there. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does.
So, and maybe that's not fair. I keep thinking of that AT&T commercial that's out right now where the girl says that's not fair. It's a great commercial. Maybe that's not fair, but that's the reality that you're living in. Like, you have to be able, when you get there, you have to, like, kids like that need to be understood in that context. And sometimes that's hard. That's a hard deal, because at UCF, you're not getting the five stars either way. You're just not. I think Scott knows how to do it because Scott did it at Oregon. He developed five-star players there, so he knew how to do it. But I think sometimes you've got to reorient the way that you approach it. And Mickey Joseph understands he wants to get elite players, and then he is going to give them elite development, which means having to ask questions like why, which means having to push them in a way that maybe they don't always appreciate, because on the back end, they're going to be developed, all those things. So I think that'll be something worth watching. And I'm not just talking about sports when I talk about that. That's just a management idea in general. If you're going to hire the best salesperson from wherever you're from, you have to have the expectation that when that salesperson comes in, they're going to expect all the people around them to be really good salespeople too. And they will get frustrated when they don't get that. And I think to relate it back to basketball, Kobe Webster came from a program where he was the guy at Western Illinois. He was like the guy. I think Kobe's expectation for his head coach is that everybody's going to be held accountable the way that Kobe Webster thinks they should be held accountable. And each person comes with their own context, and a good manager like Hoiberg or whomever that is has to balance those contexts, has to. You've got to figure out who's the person that you can hold accountable and who's the person has to learn accountability. And if you think a freshman who's a really dynamic scorer is going to have a fully bodied understanding of what accountability looks like day in and day out, then good luck. Because almost always a 19-year-old is not going to have the best worldview of that perspective.
To that point, I would say that you also need to realize that the rules are not the same for everybody. Like, accountability is not created equal, especially on sports teams, right? Like, the best players have a different set of rules, as particularly on the basketball court. There are shots that Kevin Durant can take that Patty Mills on the same team can't take. To your point about Joseph as a salesman, I think that's spot on. Like, the comparison to salesman is so easy with the recruiters because they are selling you on a program. But like, I think back to I brought this up when we were first talking about his hire, the story he told about when he was recruiting Jamar Chase and he just didn't let Chase get off the phone. Like, that's the kind of hustle, that's the same kind of hustle that a salesman would take to trying to seal a deal with someone that he took with trying to land Chase. And speaking of Chase, I think all the stuff that you said about being a great recruiter is true. That's why he's connecting and he has these connections in Omaha. All that is why it seems like the early returns are pretty good on him in Omaha. But I also think, like, the credibility that comes with turning out guys like Jamar Chase, like Justin Jefferson, it just cannot be. And it's not just because those guys are two of the best young wide receivers in the NFL right now, and they are, but they're also two of the most, like, culturally relevant wide receivers in the NFL right now. Like, when you watch a highlight tape of a high school kid and they're scoring all these touchdowns, what do they do afterward? They do the gritty. Just like Justin Jefferson and Jamar Chase do the gritty in the end zone after they score. These are guys who are in their face all the time. They're on their fantasy teams, and like, Justin Jefferson, I think Justin Jefferson was like a 3-star recruit or something like that, but Ja'Marr Chase was a high level, 4-star guy. So Mickey Joseph can say to those kids who ask a lot of questions, yeah, Ja'Marr Chase asked me the same thing. Like, yeah, oh yeah, you think like him. Being able to draw those connections is so powerful to the kids who grow up wanting to be like them and love them and like start them on their fantasy team and pick them first every year. Like that stuff matters too. Them being able to connect those dots. And I think particularly in a state like Nebraska, where like pro football fandom's kind of all over the place, right? Because there's no professional team here. So, kids in my generation have naturally, even if you do grow up in like a professional sports rich city, have gravitated towards being fans of players over teams anyways. But I think that's probably more pronounced here. I don't know this to be true, but I would guess that it's probably more pronounced here because there's less of a professional sports presence in the city. And, maybe Mickey can draw that connection to, Zach Taylor played at Nebraska and he coaches Cincinnati and, Ja'Marr Chase plays for Cincinnati, but no, he could also just say, I recruited this kid. I stayed up all night on the phone with this kid and I helped him turn into who he is today. And that goes a long way, even longer. If someone wanted to stay on the phone with a kid just as long as Mickey Joseph did, but that guy didn't recruit Ja'Marr Chase, I think the kid's going to side with Mickey Joseph most of the time.
I want to read you guys a quote from Mickey Joseph from a conversation I had with him just recently about recruiting locally. I think it's interesting. It speaks to the mindset. He says, it's hard in state. It's hard to make quick decisions in state just because you got to be right. If you're not right, you can't really get out of it. You can't call back and say, hey, we're going in a different direction. You can't do that. So in state, sometimes it takes a little longer for the evaluation process compared to out of state. In state, they're your backyard. You cannot miss in state because if you do miss, that kid is still coming because that's the rules of the game.
Yep.
And I think what's interesting about that quote to me is it's not coming from the perspective of, hey, how are we as Nebraska going to relate to these guys and get them to come here? It flips it on its head and says, we're so confident that these guys are going to come here that we can't miss on who we evaluate and who we allow to come here. And I think that's a mentality that it's totally been the other way for a long time, where Nebraska's tried to, for the last, 15 years, tried to crack the code of the metro and get some of these guys to come consistently to Nebraska. It's a totally different mindset. And to your point too, Sam, it's about relationships, where Mickey Joseph knows a lot of these guys already. And, it might not produce somebody this year or next year, but eventually it probably will, because there's a history of talent coming out of a lot of these schools. So it is, I think it really does mark sort of a big paradigm shift in how Nebraska through Joseph is going to recruit that area.
That quote is fascinating to me because it creates sort of this magical illusionary wall around Nebraska now, where it's just like, say you're a kid at the lunch table trading lunches and you both have your boxes closed. It's like, and the kid said, well, I want to give you an apple. And you're like, well, I might have something a little bit more interesting in here. The kids might throw you more, right? They're going to be more interested in what you got. And that's kind of, that quote is Mickey Joseph saying, well, we might have to be more selective because we might have more talent than we know what to do with. And that inherently is going to make kids, well, why is there so much talent over there? Why might I not be good enough? That's going to make them, it's kind of like negging in the dating world a little bit. It's like, well, what don't I have that draws more people to them? I think that's I don't know if Mickey Joseph was thinking about it that way when he said it, but that's something that jumped out to me when I heard you read that, Evan.
Well, the challenge with recruiting in state has always been this, that you can't be wrong, because if you get him, here's the thing, and he didn't say this part, but if you're wrong, they're not going to leave the school after a year. That's mm-hmm. the thing.
Right.
They're wrong on recruits all the time from out of state. But guess what? They leave because they don't want to stick around because they're not from here. A kid, an in-state recruit who doesn't pan out, doesn't leave right away. They just don't. And then it becomes, why aren't you playing the guy? And what's this like? That's what it becomes. It becomes the Micah Krackmeyer thing from back. You know, he was the first guy Bo offered, and then he got hurt, and he never left, and he was there for 5 years. Or it becomes the receiver from Waverly who was around for 5 years. That's what it becomes. And so then it and I remember this being a critique that like when CJ Johnson came out, you know, and CJ was at Bell West and he went to Wyoming, and the general thought, and he didn't run a great 40 at his camp or whatever. And it was like, well, if we take a chance on this guy, he's going to come here, and you know, I've got to go over and get this guy over here. And if he doesn't pan out, he'll leave, but you know, he's going to stick around. Well, I'll tell you what, the fact that CJ didn't go to Nebraska probably cost him the next two. All because of a decision that I think Tim Beck is a good recruiter, but at the end of the day, Tim Beck made that decision. It wasn't necessarily Rich Fisher. So those kind of things crop up. It's hard. It's a difficult situation. And it comes up in basketball too. It's like, there's always, you have to, in this job, you've got to be, what's the right word? You've got to hope that you get a little bit of a motivational and emotional boost from the in-state kids. That's the key. You feel like you're getting something, you're getting an added benefit. Garrett Nelson's passion for the program is going to earn you something, or so goes the thinking.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. The benefit of a contributing in-state kid is really high, because those kids are going to stick around and you don't get that benefit from somebody who's on the outside. So kind of expanding this to beyond in-state, when you look at the 2023 class, I mean, just in the last week with the open recruiting period that's been going on, you can see Nebraska starting to get out. So Joseph was in Omaha. This week he was in St. Louis trying to crack an area that Nebraska has not had much luck in. Donovan Riola, the new offensive line coach, was back in Wisconsin sending out some offers. Of course, he played line for the Badgers when he was in college too. Travis Fisher back in Florida, so on and so forth. Nebraska's putting out offers in Texas and that area too. It's just kind of interesting, I think, when you look at recruiting going forward. I don't know about you guys, but like, it's just kind of interesting, because in the last couple months, as the transfer portal has played out, we've sort of researched and talked to all these guys, like, it just feels different than it did even a year ago, with the way that the cycles go now, because it feels like, you know, 2 years ago, you would start a new class and you'd think, all right, well, now they're going to be on their way to 23, 24, 25 scholarship additions. And now it feels like maybe it'll be half that, and then maybe they'll go to the portal for the rest. And, you know, I think you guys can probably relate, but I do research on some of these guys that Nebraska's added. Like, DeColdis Crawford was committed to LSU for years. And so, like, reading back on some of his early, like when it was two cycles away or a cycle away from him ending up somewhere, and like reading his thought process at that time, it was totally different from what it ended up being. So I don't know. I feel like I'm looking at recruiting differently than I have before, because again, it feels like so much is fluid, more fluid with the transfer portal, to where sure, you're going to get a handful of guys that'll commit and be part of the, you know, part of the fray, part of the group right away. But it feels like a lot of other guys are going to be, you know, circumstantial ads based on coaches that come or go or things that happen later on. So do you feel that way when you guys look at recruiting? Because it just feels different moving forward to me now.
I was thinking of from this aspect, for the coaches who are already living and breathing this, you know, 25-8, you hear a lot of these transfer portal situations as being the team that finished second, but then stayed in contact. So like the cycle never really ends, you know, right? Like it's so all encompassing now. And like, if you're a recruit now, that you have to, I don't know, your calculus changes. Like if I go here and it doesn't work out there, like, okay, for example, if I'm a recruit, I want to go to Mickey Joseph era LSU as a wide receiver, it doesn't pan out for me there, it's easier for me to sell like it was just a really crowded room at LSU than it is for me to sell if I didn't work out at, you know, some smaller school. So like, I just feel like the whole decision-making calculus has changed, and we're all going to learn a lot new about it as so are the coach. Like, this is an entire new world that we're entering in right now. Recruits, coaches, media. I don't think I'm saying anything fresh there, but it's a lot to juggle right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that we're in a disruption period in terms of the history of recruiting and in college athletics. We'll be diving more into that here toward the end of the month and in February about NIL and other things. It's hard to know exactly where it's going. And it's hard because I create, you know, as a person who works through these processes, I use two things. I use binaries and I use DBT. It's called dialectical behavioral therapy. So I try to create binary questions where I feel like you get on the poles of things and then you eliminate what's not till you get to the locus of what, you know, the range of what would be. And, you know, I think as it relates to recruiting, the thing that I would say about Nebraska is they've got to figure out who they want to be in that area. And I would go so far as to say, you know, here are the positions where we're cool with X, Y, and Z, 5 stars. Here's where we want to just be who we want to be. And I'd almost have that be a fairly portable structure, regardless of who your assistants are. I think Nebraska lost a pretty good player, Evan, in Wenda Huahuli, who went into the transfer portal. We'll see, right? He hasn't played football in a while. And so there's something there where he hasn't played a lot of football because he's hurt, or he was in Hawaii and COVID and all that. But, you know, that's the pratfall of having a Hawaii recruiter who then leaves to go to Oregon so that he can recruit that region a little bit more easily. And then you lose the player. And then maybe you're not even going back out there anymore. Maybe they are. I don't know. They could. They got Mackenzie Milton from there. But I don't think in this day and age you can be all. And Nebraska is still feels like they're in this all stage. It's Omaha, Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, New Jersey, Alabama, Ellis, you know, Louisiana, Texas, maybe California. Like, it's just really hard. It's really hard to be that. Like, it's hard to be all things to all people. And so I think they're going to have to try to tailor that or narrow it down. Because, again, maybe it is a great idea to go into St. Louis, but you haven't had any success there. And in order to have success there, I think you're going to have to do some certain things. Maybe Mickey Joseph can do that, but a lot of people just, you know, you got to basically get in with like 4 or 5 coaches. In Kansas City, they've had very little success. You know, and maybe Royola will have incredible success in Chicago. In theory, he could. But you've got to define that for your recruiters. And then as long as you're head coach, you got to continue to be – that needs to be your benchmark. And we'll see if Frost does that. Like, I think a lot of times what he does is he kind of lets his guys kind of turn loose, recruit where they're strong. And I get all that. I get it. But I think maybe just a little tighter identity there where you say, you know, we're not going to recruit this place anymore because we just don't see it panning out. I've said this for many years. I don't think it's worth recruiting the West Coast for offensive and defensive linemen because they don't come to Nebraska, or if they do, they're major project players who didn't have offers from the West Coast. That's just now Nebraska's recruited a couple D linemen, and I guess we'll see how it goes. That's all I can, you know, and maybe Donovan Rayola can recruit Hawaii. He probably can, and he'll probably bring a guy or two, but Hawaii is not the closed recruiting area that it was in 1997 when George Darlington was one of the handful of coaches out there. Everyone recruits Hawaii now, and so it's harder to get the kids here. So all those things, it feels new, but at the same time, you've got to figure out like what the got to narrow some things out and then become what you're, you know, about. Yeah, that was a long answer. I apologize.
No, and to that point too, I mean, just the sheer numbers of offers that Nebraska puts out under this staff. I mean, they're routinely top five in the country in terms of offers they put out every cycle, many hundreds. And we've seen it even just these last couple of days. I mean, they put out dozens of offers in St. Louis and down south and around the country. And, you know, their strategy in doing that is to sort of be a conversation starter and get guys to campus. You know, that's how they express interest. And then guys come to campus and the school sort of sells itself. But I think there's also a risk there of sort of devaluing Nebraska's interest in a prospect, because they know, like, when Wisconsin offers or when Northwestern offers or when Iowa offers, like, that's a bigger deal because they are pretty selective with that. And so I wonder if that's maybe part of it too, where instead of sort of using them as conversation starters, you know, it can mean a little bit more than it has in the last handful of years.
I think your point, Sam, about it all feels new. I mean, you kind of brushed over that, but that's a huge part of this, right? Like, yeah, they didn't have success in Kansas City and St. Louis before, but that was with a different coaching staff. This is, you know, Mickey Joseph's recruiting superstar. Bill Bush is recruiting superstar. Donovan Raiola has, in theory, a disproportionate amount of credibility having worked for the Chicago Bears. So yeah, why not send to Chicago? And I think Scott this is all what you're saying is maybe trying to tell guys to rein it in a little bit. That's all part of, to me at least, Scott's new role as CEO, which he's probably still feeling out. He's always been like a football schematics first kind of coach. And it's hard for Scott to tell Mickey Joseph, recruiting specialist, where he should or should not commit his resources, I'm sure, because Mickey's had so much success. And right now, they've built a good amount of positive momentum. The recruiting class just snuck into the top 40. The transfer portal class, I believe, is top 12, top 10, something like that. So I think right now they're just dipping their toe in and seeing what they can do. I think you're 100% right. If they continue to draw blank in some of these areas, then yeah, sure, maybe reel it in a little bit. But right now, I don't know, you got something going. Why not see how far you can push it?
I think that's about what we have for today, unless you guys want to add anything else.
Jimmy, do you think on another podcast, our Husker Extra one, we were talking about the next five games, right? Well, how many of those do you think Nebraska can win and should win?
Oh, unmute, man.
Okay, give me a second. I was pulling up the schedule. Can you hear me now? We're good?
Yeah.
Okay. Should win. I mean, it's hard to say this team should win any of these games. Rutgers, it seems strange to say it because they got just whacked at Rutgers. Rutgers is the best shot. Rutgers and Minnesota are the two best shots. I don't know. And Northwestern. I don't know. All Northwestern is a team that has lost, I think, 6 of 7. They're trending in a downward direction right now, but they still have good. I think it would be a success for them to win. I mean, anything, but two is a good number. Three would be, all right, now we are starting to at least separate ourselves and beat some of the teams on our level, which they haven't beaten much of anyone in the Big Ten. So I don't know, Wisconsin's a no. And I think Michigan is looking, trending in the right direction, especially on the road. That's going to be tough. 2 and 3, 3 and 2 would be a rousing success, but I think you got to start with one. One would be great.
If they can only win one of the next five, how many of the five after that are they going to win?
Maryland, Northwestern are both possible. But I mean, again, momentum is something that good vibes can snowball on top of itself. So
sure.
I think if they only win one of these next five, they're probably going to not win very many of the five after that.
So you think if you were going to say Nebraska's favored,
I would say in zero of those games, they'll be favored.
So they're not favored to win another game again this year.
Maybe
forget what KenPom says.
I'm not. I know. I'm thinking.
You don't think they're going to win another. You don't think they're favored to win any games?
I'm not thinking about KenPom. I'm thinking about Las Vegas. In Las Vegas.
Vegas is a betting line. All right. Forget it. Tell me what you think about how many games they're going to win in the next five.
I will say two.
Okay. I get it. Vegas is going to say what Vegas is going to say. Vegas said Nebraska football was going to win seven.
But favored just has a different connotation. Like that's that when I think favored, I think gambling line.
Sure. But like, again, Vegas said Nebraska's going to beat Purdue and Nebraska. Sure. I mean, Vegas said all those things. And I remember maybe it was you were like, I don't trust Nebraska to win another game until they actually do it. And that's if you don't think they're going to win any of them, that's fine with me.
I mean, math says they'll win one of them. Sure, they have to, right? I would not in any of those individual games. I don't think I would pick them because I just need to see it.
Okay. And guess what? I think that's an entirely possible conclusion. I'm not necessarily saying they're going to do anything because I think it's possible that, you know. On my previous podcast, the answer is, well, they should win three. And I'm,
why?
Okay. I don't think they should.
Why? Yeah, I don't understand.
I don't know. I'm at where you're at. Until they win a game, I don't think they're going to win one.
Yeah.
Like they actually have to win one. And because there's things that happen at the end of the Indiana game that would indicate that they don't know how.
So, I mean, I think it would be a situation where they need to, like, winning close just seems really hard for them right now. So, I think it would be great for them to just make a bunch of threes and beat one of these teams by 15 points.
Because KenPom does say they're not going to win another game.
Yeah, I think KenPom, let me see here. KenPom's got them. Their best shot per KenPom is 41% against Rutgers on Saturday.
Yeah, well, you never know.
Has him for two more wins.
I trust Jimmy's eyes. You've seen them all. You've seen every play of the season. So
I'm so sorry. well, our podcast wins every week. So I putting this one in the W column again. Well, we'll be back, I imagine, next week. Yeah. With some more basketball having been played, men and women. We'll be at the traditional signing deadline on February 2nd. So we'll have a little bit of a closure there for the class. And then we can start turning ahead to spring ball and baseball and everything else after that. But we'll call it good for this one today. Stay warm out there and, recruit well. Have a good one.